This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. I'm Danielle Laporte, and I'm here with Linda Sievertson, where we are chatting with some of the most amazing authors, publishing leaders, and creatives. Between the two of us, Linda and I have written something like 12 books, including our co-creation, Your Big Beautiful Book Plan. And we're here because we love this game. We love everything about the publishing industry, about getting ideas out into the world and being as creative as you possibly can. This all started with us interviewing some of our favorite agents and fellow authors for a membership group that we have called the Beautiful Writers Group. And because we don't believe friends should let their friends write alone, we are sharing the interviews with you. So for the next 45 minutes, because 45 minutes is a new hour, we will be digging deep and going for the light. Welcome. Hey everyone, Danielle has a special announcement at the end of our show, so I hope you will be able to stay on with us until the close. We are so blessed to have Marianne Williamson with us today. She's a spiritual teacher, the author of 11 books, four of which were number one New York Times bestsellers, and the founder of Project Angel Food, a Meals on Wheels program that serves homebound people with AIDS in the LA area. She's also the co-founder of the Peace Alliance, a grassroots campaign that supports legislation to establish a United States Department of Peace. She works tirelessly to end poverty in the United States and around the world. In other words, this woman does not mess around. Newsweek magazine has called her one of the 50 most influential baby boomers. In 2013, Marianne ran for Congress, and her message of love and forgiveness brought uncharacteristic goodness to the political conversation. Unfortunately, it wasn't a message that everyone was ready for, but that I think we can all agree is needed more now than ever. Marianne's new book, Tears to Triumph, The Spiritual Journey from Suffering to Enlightenment, has been out for a few days now, and we are elated to have her here while she's on tour. Thank you so much for being here, Marianne. We're such huge fans.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be with you, and I appreciate you having me.
Danielle, you want to do your blessing? Or actually, why don't you both do a blessing? How's that for improv?
Well, I'll grease the wheel for Marianne so she doesn't have to like bring down the Holy Spirit right away. So wherever you are, it's always a great idea to breathe. And we declare that we are here now to give witness to a shared truth that absolutely everything is progress, that we have all that we need, and that brilliance is unfolding here and now. And by brilliance, we mean light.
Marianne, you do not have to do a prayer right now, but I do think you must have a pretty good creativity prayer. Maybe we could close with that or something.
Well, I was just going to say, and so it is.
That's perfect. So I'll start. Marianne, I'm so addicted to this new book, Tears to Triumph. And before we dig into its content, I do want to go back a bit, cover a little bit of your history. I used to work at the Bodhi Tree bookstore in LA, and it was there shelving books that it occurred to me that not every single one of the 30,000 titles we carried was written by somebody who was totally more qualified than I was to write. And that was a really freeing realization for me. In 1979, you worked at a metaphysical bookstore in Houston. Did you ever have any such thoughts while you were shelving books?
No, I didn't. It wasn't until I started lecturing in about 1983. After I'd been doing that for 5 years, I had dinner one night in San Francisco with Jerry Jampolsky. Jampolsky had written really the first popularized book on the principles of The Course in Miracles. And he said to me that night, he said, "You ought to write a book." And I said, "Well, other people have told me that, but I don't feel pregnant with a book." And he said, "All of the information that you would need is in these talks you've been giving, and you have tapes." And I said, "Yeah, but I don't know how to get what's in a talk onto a page." And he said, "Well, let's agree in consciousness in this moment that there is someone out there who could help you take your words from a speech to a book." And that was a Thursday night. And then 2 days later, I was talking in Los Angeles, and somebody came up to me after my talk and said that they were a literary agent. I gave them my phone number. This was before cell phones. I don't know if they ever called, but I got a call. And then 5 days after that, which was exactly 1 week after Jerry Jampolsky. So I was with Jerry on a Thursday night in San Francisco. I was approached by an agent who then I never heard from again on Saturday in L.A. And then a few days later, Thursday night in New York City, another man approached me who was a literary agent in New York. He said, have you ever thought of writing a book? I said, people keep saying that. I don't know. I don't feel pregnant with a book. He said, well, they're in your tapes. I said, I don't know how to get it from the tapes to a page. And he said, well, I can help you do that. And that's how my book became a book and became published. So, no, that's how it unfolded.
We are always telling everybody, your life is your content. It's there in your workshops. It's there in the conversations you have with your girlfriends every morning while you're making your smoothie. It's always right there. I want to say it's like part admission and part permission inspiration for everybody else. It took me 7 years to go through the Course in Miracles. And I found it in a bookstore in Ann Arbor. And I've just been writing this actually about my new age journey. I was 15. I'd been hanging out with my mom and her new age friend. And they took me to this old store, and it was like something out of Harry Potter. And my friend said to her mom, do you think she's ready? And her mom said, she's ready. And they handed me in the Course in Miracles. And 7 years later, I did the last exercise. Can you just drop us into how it came into your life?
I saw the book on a coffee table at a party in New York City. I was in my mid-20s, and I picked up the book, and I noticed at the very beginning that there was no author on the front. And the first page I read was the introduction. And the introduction says, this is a required course. And I thought, what kind of book tells you it's required reading? And of course, when you learn more, it's not saying this particular form of the information is required. It's really just a way of saying a spiritual journey is what everybody's on, and one day you'll realize this. But I thought that was such odd language. And then I closed it. I kept looking for an author. I thought it was so interesting. So then I kept reading, and I saw the traditional Christian language. I'm Jewish, and I had taken a lot of Christian theology in college, but this was different because this was a party, you know, this was private life. And so I was a little uncomfortable with that. I put it down. And then a year later, I used to take a bus up and down Central Park West in New York City. And I had been told that night at that party that the books were published at an apartment building, which is still there, a famous apartment building in New York City called the Beresford. Mm-hmm. And so I would pass the Beresford and I would remember that. And one day I was on the bus and I saw a man sitting across from me reading A Course in Miracles. And I looked at him more closely. He didn't see me, but I noticed that he was a man with whom the roommate who I had lived with a couple of years before in New York City was his tenant. And they used to argue a lot. And I saw that he was reading it. So then a few months later, I was on that same bus passing that same building, going to the doctor because I used to always get bronchitis every winter when I lived in New York. And I passed that apartment building and I said to myself, it's time. And I went home that day after going to the doctor. I walked in my apartment and the Course in Miracles was sitting on my dining room table. And I looked up at my boyfriend, the man with whom I was living and who had been with me that night at that party about a year before. And I looked up at him kind of shocked. And he said, I thought it was time. And so we started it. And, you know, it's not for everyone. If it's for you, you know it. And even if it's for you, there are so many people. Like you said, you took 7 years. Of course, you were a little girl when you first found it. Some people say I had it next to my bed for years before I picked it up. It's divine timing. If it's for you, you know it. And if it's for you, you'll know when. But, you know, the Course doesn't want us to make the Course special. It is one statement of universal spiritual themes. There's one truth with a capital T. It's in so many different ways. Making the particular form of teaching special, I mean, look at all the evil done on the planet because people are attached to their one particular form. So it's not about the beliefs, it's about the experience, and that's love and forgiveness, and that's really all that matters. Yeah.
So, okay. Marianne, how have your thoughts on the Course changed over the years, if they have?
My thoughts about the Course have not changed over the years. I felt when I first read it that this was a path home for me, and I feel that way now. The Course doesn't change. Hopefully, I've become better at practicing it more consistently. But I don't kid myself about how challenging that can be at times. You know, I see doing the Course in Miracles like physical exercise. if you work it, it works. It's simple. You know, spiritual exercise is no different than physical exercise. You're training your attitudinal muscles. And I, if anything, see the message of the Course made manifest in my life more and more. You know, the Course in Miracles says that the ego or the loveless mind is suspicious at best and vicious at worst. And what do you think Orlando is, except, you know, the product of the loveless mind? All of our heartaches, individually and collectively, they are a product of the loveless mind. So doing the Course, becoming a practitioner of the Course, a miracle worker, just means that these very simple principles, and you know this, you're a student yourself, that we become more capable of applying these same principles more consistently. Growing spiritually doesn't mean that we grow more metaphysically complicated. We become more deeply able to practice the very simple principles that by now most of us know. You know, most of the people who listen to your program, who do your work, have read enough of the books, have listened enough to the tapes and all of the work that we all do, that we know the principles. I always say the era of data collection is over. Now it's about practicing the principles, and it's not easy. To say it's simple does not mean that it's always easy, but you develop that musculature, and once again, when we do it, it works. I always say, when I practice what I preach, my life really works well.
Well, since we're gathered here in the name of creativity, do you have a prayer, a specific prayer that you say before you write?
I dedicate what I'm writing to God, which means to love, that it might be of service, that it might be of use. Particularly with this last book I wrote, I have really hoped that for people who are sad or in pain or going through something, and of course we all have our sad times and our painful times, but I hope that this book will reach into the heart of whoever could be served by it. That's always my prayer. You know, I think we heal in life one aha at a time. And I think that's every writer's hope, is that there's going to be an aha in something that you wrote. Some page, some paragraph, some sentence will make somebody go, yes! That's my hope.
Okay, speaking of this new book, this really might be your most profound piece of work to date, although that's a really big statement. But can we talk about the part of the book I so identified with, was this idea that we've pathologized deep sadness. And really what a tragedy that is for everyone, including, I believe, creators, writers, and artists. Can you speak to that?
Well, first of all, thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate that. You know, there was a kind of contest, a kind of battle of words sort of, or, you know, a kind of famous relationship between two of the greatest painters of the 20th century, Pablo Picasso and Matisse, Henri Matisse. Yes. And Picasso was famous for saying that his suffering led to his creativity. And Matisse was famous for saying, I don't know, guys, I'm happy. And this really stymied Picasso. Picasso had a real problem with that because Picasso did think Matisse was the greatest painter, but he just couldn't figure out how could you be that happy and be that creative. Well, there's the two different poles, aren't they? We don't want to hold that you have to suffer in order to be creative, i.e. Matisse. But on the other hand, there is the pain that often comes with the creative process. And all that the creative process is, life itself is a creative process. We are all artists in that sense. We are all creators because God is creating through us all the time. And when you look at the model of someone like a Picasso, the idea that we suffer for our art, what does that mean? What that means is that there is pain involved sometimes in stripping away the layers of the false self. Whether it's stripping away the layer of, you know, if Picasso would paint a painting and say, no, it's not right, it's not real, and he would destroy it. Or whether you just feel you blew it in a relationship because you weren't your true self and you didn't speak your truth and you blew it. It doesn't matter. What is the true word? What is the true self? What is the true color? Well, we live in a world that is dominated by a thought system that repudiates the truth of who we are. Yes. And so we are trained mentally to download that which is false. And when we do, what we get back is pain. What we get back are painful experiences. Now, how do we learn to do differently except by taking in that pain? Psychic pain is like physical pain. It's there for a reason. It carries a message. If you have a broken leg, you can't just numb the pain, you have to reset the leg. And if you have psychic pain, you can't just numb the pain, which has become so prevalent in our society as a modality of healing, although it's not healing. Instead, we have to reset our thinking. And one of the ideas I deal with in the book, as you know, is that humanity would not have evolved over hundreds of thousands of years without being imbued with the capacity to take a hit. The body can absorb a lot of injury. The body can absorb a lot of injury and disease. That's why people die when their immune system is compromised. The body can absorb a lot of disease and injury. It's called the immune system. Well, the psyche has an immune system too. Human suffering didn't just start. The psyche is a genius at absorbing and integrating injury and suffering, and that's what grief is. But you have to let it operate. Yeah. And you know what I think of a lot of the way we numb ourselves, the way we distract ourselves, and that's what the medicalization of situational despair is. It's kind of like when you take an anti-nausea medicine, you still want to be nauseated. You have just done something to the mechanism so that you can't actually do it, which to me feels worse, right? And it's the same with psyche. So medicalizing situational despair, the point is that there is a spectrum of normal human suffering. You know, of course, if you went through a heartbreak or a painful divorce, of course that hurts. But it's not a mental illness. You have a bankruptcy or professional failure. Of course it hurts, but it's not a mental illness. You go through the loss of a loved one. Of course it hurts, but it's not a mental illness. And we are now medicalizing. We are putting a medical model onto all situational despair. They even call situational depression now an official psychiatric category. Body into the sense of victim, I have a disease, when from a spiritual perspective, you're going through what is traditionally called the dark night of the soul. It's a spiritual crisis. It's an internal crisis. And to look to a corner of the society that does not factor the soul into its calculations to solve that problem means that you're going to forever be working on the effect, but you will never address the cause. And if you don't burn through that pain, you won't see the cause. You know, let's say a bitter divorce. Let's say a bitter heartbreak. You know, I went through a relationship where I realized I spent about 3 or 4 months after it was over blaming him. About 3 or 4 months, all I could see were his mistakes. I mean, it really was a long time before. You know that Jimmy Buffett song, Margaritaville?
Yeah.
Finally, in the last verse, he says, hell, it was my own damn fault. Months have gone by before I would allow myself to face what my stuff was. Or if you have a professional failure, you know, like my having run for Congress.
Bravo for that, sister.
Well, that's very kind of you, but as you know, I lost. And afterwards, I had a lot of painful things I had to look at. You know, you have a public humiliation, you have a public failure. I lost so much of my own money, so much of other people's money, people who had donated. I felt I had let down our community. So many people were so nice. I had to forgive other people. I had to forgive myself. But I had to go through every single tear. I had to go through every single sleepless night. I wouldn't be able to speak about it now had I not processed all that. And you better believe it was painful. But I had to learn. I had to learn what the big mistake was. And, you know, I've lost my mother, I've lost my father, I've lost my sister, I've lost my best friend. You know what I learned from that? When you have lost people that you love, and at a certain point in life, if you live long enough, that does start to happen. And what it has taught me on a visceral level is this ride within the realm of time and space does not last forever. Do not waste one day not loving the people that you love. So this is where we grow wise. If you don't learn how to navigate the turbulent waters of life, if you don't learn how to navigate the rough times, you don't really know how to navigate life. And I think what's happening today is that, and I think you see it in our own community, there are a lot of men who are acting like boys out there. There are a lot of women who are acting like girls. We're infantilized. And this is a time, you look at something like what happened in Orlando the other day, this is a very serious time on the planet. This is time for very serious people to be very serious, and it's time for all of us to be very serious people. How can we be the major contributors to healing the world if we have not gone through our own healing in a way that is doing more than just numbing our pain and distracting ourselves?
Marianne, I think everybody who's been on this path for a certain amount of time, a certain amount of depth, we get to the point where we embrace that suffering creates growth for sure. Then we go to the next step. We go, oh, maybe suffering is actually necessary for growth. Can you flip that and talk about how joy helps us grow? Like, can we just go there? Like, what does joy actually do for us?
I want to say, first of all, not all suffering creates growth. Mm. If you don't learn from it, if you don't face the lessons to be learned, then you don't grow from it. You just go out on the other end and reenact the same situation. So, you know, what the Course in Miracles says is, it is not up to you what you learn. It is merely up to you whether you learn through joy or through pain. The universe is constantly giving us opportunities to learn through joy. We do not have to learn through suffering. From a Course in Miracles perspective, we're given the opportunities to learn through joy. But if we repudiate love, if we repudiate forgiveness, if we repudiate mercy, if we hold on to the past, if we try to control events, if we try to control other people, then we will suffer, and we will or we will not learn. And then if we do learn the lesson from the suffering that we cause, then we will go forth in a way that we don't have to create all that suffering anymore, because we're going to be different. We're going to do it differently. You know, that's why I wake up in the morning and I do the Course in Miracles, because I don't want to mess with myself today. You learn that, you know, your mind, when it is not disciplined to love, is a very dangerous thing to yourself and others. So I think a dedication to happiness, a dedication to joy, it is a dedication to love and to forgiveness. So I think joy is the most transformative thing in the world. But in order to have that, the Course in Miracles says you achieve so little because your minds are undisciplined. Look at the Matisse image. You know, he said, I'm happy. So, no, I agree with you. We don't have to learn through suffering. It's just, I think if most of us are honest with ourselves, many times we have. And sometimes, you know, hey, somebody around you that you love dies. You know, you didn't do anything to create that suffering. But it is to be honored for the lessons to be learned nonetheless.
Marianne, I'd love to ask you about when you were first speaking, you basically created a career for yourself. We talked with Martha Beck, and she explained to us the coolest thing that, well, it's not cool that systems are disintegrating, but what is cool is that as systems are disintegrating, people are having to find their right work, and they're making it up, right? They're making up things that have never been before. Here you were teaching the Course in Miracles. You had no idea you were going to make any money at it. You write A Return to Love, and was it Oprah that helped it become such a launch pad?
Yes. I was pure out of naivete, kind of an idiot savant spiritually, because there was nothing to be ambitious for. You could be an academic, like maybe become a professor in comparative religion, but I didn't even graduate from college. You could be a clergy. My mother kept saying to me, your father and I have discussed it. We will send you to rabbinical school. I didn't feel that that was my path. So the idea of a woman who just got up and talked about A Course in Miracles, this was not a career niche. So I had no reason to think that it ever would be. You know, I read a quote from Oprah the other day, speaking of Oprah. I read a quote from her the other day, and she said the reason that she thinks she has been so financially successful is because she has never done anything for the money. And I find in my own life, anytime I've tried to do something in order to get a worldly result, that limits our power. It's when you do something in order to be of service. You just want it to be a vessel of love, whatever you're doing. That invites the abundance of the universe, because on all levels, because that's when you're living from a truly abundant place.
Oh, that's beautiful.
All right, let's do an intermission. So, Marianne, we do either or questions. All right, you ready? It's multiple choice.
Okay.
Shall we go? All right. Rumi or Rilke?
I could not make that choice. I need them both.
Okay. I know you've just relocated, but I'm going to ask this anyway. L.A. or New York?
Can't make that choice.
Okay, all right. Cake or pasta?
Unfortunately, pasta. Okay, it would be unfortunate either way, but right. I can say no to cake much more easily than I can say no to pasta.
Meditation or prayer?
Just words. Oneness with God, listening is both.
Sleep or sex?
Oh, I have to choose. No, both.
You just can't do both at the same time. Okay, and the one guilty pleasure that you're not guilty about at all whatsoever? I'll give you mine if it helps. Reading People magazine in the bathtub, eating chips.
Oh, yeah.
No guilt whatsoever.
Okay. Let me. I'm trying. I promise I'm trying.
You're too pure. You become too ascended.
Mine isn't as interesting as yours. Eating corn nuts.
Oh, yum.
Okay. That'll work.
Do feel guilty. That's the problem.
Thou shalt not eat corn nuts.
Especially not. I don't think they have corn nuts that are non-GMO.
Oh, yeah. Then you should throw that in just for effect. Eating GMO corn nuts.
We're going to get a letter, and somebody's going to say they do have corn nuts that are non-GMO, by the way. So, Marianne, I tell all of my clients that they will never, ever be able to jump on all of the marketing or PR opportunities that come their way when their book comes out. And they tell me later that this is the one thing that keeps them from going crazy. So what is the best piece of book advice that anyone ever told you?
Well, I don't know the best advice anyone ever told me, but I can tell you the best advice that I can share from my heart, and that is to forget everything that you just mentioned. Don't even think about it. I'll tell you a story. When my second book came out, Oprah had, as you mentioned before, pretty much made, you know, she had not just pretty much, she made A Return to Love. She said it was her favorite book, best book she'd ever read theretofore. She bought 1,000 copies and really gave me my national and international career. My second book came out. Integrity, just integrity, integrity would demand that I would do nothing until I had heard from Oprah. Because Oprah deserved to do whatever she wanted with that second book, given that she loved the first one. You with me?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because my first one was so successful, I now had a big contract and publicist and publisher and all that stuff. And they kept talking about a national show to launch the book. And the Oprah show had not gotten back to us. I would meditate. And I would pray, and I would get, do nothing, just wait. She wasn't saying anything. Her show wasn't saying anything. My publisher, the publicist, all that team, PR, all that stuff you're talking about, started pressuring me. We need to do a show. We need to do a national show. She's not getting back to us. I would pray, and I would get, just wait, do nothing. I would get back from all the voices of the world, the publicists, the PR, all that shit you're talking about, girl. Well, we have to do a national show. See, you got to have a launch for a national show. I would pray. I would meditate. Do nothing. Plus, if not only did I give in and not go with that, but I also, as I said to you before, integrity would demand. Integrity would demand. You know what, guys? Until we hear from Oprah, we're keeping this open. But I didn't have that strength yet. I didn't know to ignore this stuff. I didn't know how corrupt it was. So what we did was we agreed to another show. I remember the day, I don't forget. We talked about being in the bathtub a few minutes ago, eating the chips. I'm in the bathtub, right? And in those days, we had phone machines. And I hear the call come in, I'm in the bathtub, and I hear Oprah's voice. You've done it again. I like this one even better. This is a woman's worth. You have done it. This is my favorite, blah, blah, blah. Can't wait to have you on. We had already committed to another show, and her rules, which I respect, but if you do another, we're not doing. So all I had to do was listen to that still small voice within. And because I was listening to what promotion and all that stuff was about, and, you know, anybody sophisticated enough to think about it can only imagine how much money I lost. So, you know, the same thing was true with my political campaign. You know, in the Course in Miracles, it says, is it reasonable to assume I would give you a job to do, but then not provide you with the means of its accomplishment? So, like I said before, my life works really well when I practice what I preach. So after my campaign and that period, the dark night of my soul, figuring it out, what went wrong? What went wrong? Well, I'll tell you what went wrong. I was very prayerful about whether or not to run. But once I ran, I listened to political consultants more than to the small, still voice within. So whenever I hear all that stuff that we're supposed to do to be successful, my advice is ignore it, go into the peace of your heart, meditate, pray, ask for guidance. Then, yes, you will listen to experts, and you will, but they will be your consultants. And the deepest decision-making will be from that small, still voice within that you will hear in the silence of your heart.
Amen.
Creativity, that's exactly what you were talking about before. That is the creative process. The same place you go to find the right word to say or the right word to write or the right color to paint is the same place you should go to decide how to promote your book or whatever.
It's all sacred.
It's all sacred. Exactly. It's all sacred. As Einstein said, either everything's a miracle or nothing's a miracle. He says in the Course in Miracles, every problem you have, you think you have many different problems, but the only problem you have is a separation from God. And that gets us back into all the depressing times and the sad times. Where is my thinking separate from God's thinking? Because when I make that transition to God's thinking, my suffering will transform.
This is a Marianne quote. The universe supports life from an embryo to a baby and beyond. That there is an invisible hand in the universe that's programmed to give you the best path possible. But we're the ones who deviate from those perfect, self-organizing, self-correcting patterns. How do you get back on? How do you get back in sync with a benevolent, universal support system?
You know, when you meditate, when you pray, it's like a chiropractic adjustment of the soul. You know, in chiropractics, you're getting all the energy recalibrated and put back into alignment. And that's what yoga does. That's what prayer does. That's what meditation does. That's what a serious spiritual path does. That's what forgiveness does. It's not mental. It's spiritual in the sense that it is the mind when it is returned to love.
I love the Einstein-friendly universe concept that you talk about. And I still say that, you know, where will you have me go, God, prayer. So at its core, it's all about love, isn't it?
It's all about love. But it's that to say it's all about love, that's not gooey or a pink gauzy. That means in any given moment, am I rising to the occasion? Am I being ethical? Am I being impeccable? Am I being loving? Am I being of service? Am I being of use? Or am I grasping and controlling and trying to get? You know, it's really that mental practice, that mental discipline. Am I coming from what I can give or am I coming from what I can get? Am I living in the past or am I living in the future? Am I trying to control someone else or am I respecting where other people are? You know, it's that moment by moment, and that's it's a musculature. It really is an attitudinal musculature. And it's in contrast to the mental musculature that rules the world.
So, Marianne, what happens now when you have an idea for a book? And do you know when you're writing or wrapping up a book, do you already have the vision for the next one? And if and when you do, what's the process for you?
Well, you know, I very much admire and respect Annie Lamott, who wrote a wonderful book about writing. And she says that the writer should write every day. And I guess in a way I do because I'm always on Facebook with my public page. But I don't do that disciplined writing every day. For me, it's pregnancy. It's you're pregnant with a book. It lives inside you. It gestates. My next book, theoretically, is about Jesus, metaphysical Jesus, Jesus from a non-doctrinal perspective. And I'm pregnant with it. I am looking right now, as I speak to you, I am looking out at the most gorgeous quad. I live in an apartment that is on the grounds of a theological seminary. And I absolutely know that I was like sent here. It is so gorgeous. And I thought, this isn't an accident. Maybe I can audit a class here on the New Testament. And I'm thinking that I'm going to go live in Jerusalem for a month next year. So it's all happening inside. I'm allowing all these pieces to come to me inside. And there will be a time when those external manifestations, you know, you can't rush pregnancy. And your subconscious knows, you know, when a book deadline is or whatever. And so right now I'm pregnant with it and I'm thinking, but no words are on the page yet. They will be there when they can be real, when they can be authentic. You know, Hemingway said, when the story stops writing itself, put down the pencil. And you were talking about Rilke before. Rilke said, only write if you have to write. In Letters to a Young Poet, which to me is the greatest advice to writers ever.
Oh, yeah. Now, you say in this new book, well, actually, you use the stories of Buddha, Moses, and Jesus to illustrate your points. How did you choose those three and not anyone else?
Well, they're the only three that I feel that I can, with integrity, legitimately write about with any level of understanding that makes it appropriate. I mean, I don't know enough about Muhammad. I don't know enough about Hinduism. And, you know, you can't righteously write a book about something you don't know anything about. But I felt that I had enough of an understanding of the metaphysics of Buddhism, the metaphysics of the story of Exodus, and the metaphysics of Jesus. And the point there that I was so turned on by and am so, you know, it's not enough to say to people, don't numb your pain. It's not enough to say to people, don't distract yourself. What we want to do is say, and what I feel I hope I do with this book, is there is another way. All the great religious systems, and I use Buddha and Moses and Jesus as examples of spiritual transmissions. That's what the great spiritual teachings are. They're coded messages. They are spiritual transmissions, and they all speak to the reality of human suffering. Buddha said the essence of his teaching is that life is suffering. The story of the Exodus begins because the Israelites are suffering as slaves in Egypt. Jesus suffered on the cross. But all three stories and all the great religious teachings and spiritual teachings and philosophies tell the story of the transformation. So Buddha begins with the realization of suffering, and this begins his journey of enlightenment that culminates in his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, which is the state of nirvana. The Israelites start as suffering slaves, take their journey through the desert, during which time they suffered, but ultimately made it to the promised land. Jesus suffered on the cross. So you have the Israelites going through their symbolic 40 years, Jesus going through the symbolic 3 days, and ultimately ending in resurrection. So whether you're talking about nirvana, enlightenment, the promised land, resurrection, or inner peace, it's all speaking to the evolution of consciousness to the point where we have overcome the illusion of the separate self. That's what Jesus meant when he said, I have overcome. I have overcome the consciousness that keeps me bound to my suffering because it keeps me bound to my belief that I am separate from the rest of the universe. And so the great spiritual transmissions are all vortexes where when you have someone like a Jesus, like a Buddha, like a Moses, whose minds expanded to that realm where infinite possibility emerged, where they could heal the sick, they could raise the dead, they could part the Red Sea, they could turn the water into wine, they could hit a rock with their rod and water would come out because their mind had evolved. And when we allow our minds to be under, in the case of Jesus, that tutelage, under the case of Buddha, in that same place, and in the case of the Israelites, into that covenant, which is that realization, then our minds too can expand. And that is the purpose of our lives, to get there.
Marianne, do you have a preference between the word hope or optimism?
That's very interesting. I think it's a very interesting question. It's a very good question. Mm-hmm. If you're staying within a secular context, optimism does it. Hope, to me, takes us into a place, you know, hope is born of participation in hopeful solutions. So when your hope is intimately connected to your own sense of responsibility to provide hope for others, then it's something beyond optimism. It's knowledge. If I want something down on the ground and I know that if I just let it fall from my hands, gravity will take it there, I don't just hope that gravity will work. I know that gravity will work. And blessed are those who have faith who cannot see. If you're an airline pilot and you can't see the horizon because there is a strong cloud cover, you still know the horizon is there. You just know that today you can't see it. So the pilot doesn't just hope that there's a horizon. The pilot knows there's a horizon. He or she just can't see it right now. So in that moment, you fly on instruments. So hope in things unseen means knowledge of things unseen. Maybe I can't see the light beyond this darkness, but I don't just hope it's there. If I'm coming from a spiritual intelligence, I know it's there.
What makes you hopeful now?
You know, we're living at an extraordinary time, an extraordinary time on the planet. The darkness is ascending, but so is the light. Yeah. And I, every single day, you know, I'm living in New York now, so I'm in public transportation a lot. So I'm always asking, I always talk to people, who do you think should be president or whatever? I am constantly reminded how smart people really are, how noble people really are, if you really engage them in conversation. And I think also in the kind of community that you and I belong to, I think we have a critical mass of people who've read the books, who have listened to the tapes, who are already meditating, who are already seeking to forgive and to practice these principles. We just all need to step it up. The universe is endlessly malleable. It is definitely the 11th hour, but it is not midnight yet. What gives me hope that if enough of us just step on it. And I think if you look at something like Orlando and the tragedy in Orlando last weekend, on one hand, it is a sign of the ascending darkness, but I also think that it was a sea change. I think that it a lot of people awoke from their stupor and are reminded how important it is that we all rise to the occasion and do whatever we are led by our own internal guidance to do to participate in a transformation of the world.
Tears to triumph. the spiritual journey from suffering to enlightenment. Yes. Marianne, deepest respect. Yeah, what a transmission of light. So grateful to be in your presence. Your words are, they're gold. Very grateful. Thank you.
Always.
Thank you. I'm very grateful to you as well. Thank you for having me on, and congratulations, and my own acknowledgement and honor to the work that both of you do. And we're all sisters in this priestesshood, and something's going on that's very beautiful, and connectivity between and among people like ourselves is part of it. So thank you. Thank you.
Bless you. Thank you, Marianne.
God bless you. Talk to you later.
Dear beloved, beautiful listeners, this is Danielle coming at you to let you know that the shape of the podcast is transforming and expanding. Linda, you can jump in anytime. We'll be including new guests in the future. I'm going to take a backseat. I'm going to come in as a special guest because I'm so special. And this is a difficult but essential choice for my own creativity. So I hope that you hear this as a message of inspiration and some motivation to be focused on your art. I got to go write more books. I have to be the beautiful writer that I aspire to be. And this is how I have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Dee, you and I have worked together now for a really long time on multiple things. And I've always been amazed by that because in the 17 years I've known you, you're kind of a solo player. I mean, you're a rock star. So every extra year I've had with you, I've thought, I'm so happy it's continuing. So I'm just elated for every minute we've done this together. I don't totally envision how the show's going to move forward other than to say, right now I'm taking on co-hosts. So for July, Martha Beck is going to join me for the interview and we're going to bring on another person for the guest. And then in August, Danny Shapiro is going to come in and be my guest co-host. So I don't know if I'll take on a regular co-host or if it'll just be guests like that. I think it's a lot of fun just to be fluid and let this sort of unfold. And I hope everyone will stay tuned and continue to listen in and follow me on bookmama.com for updates or Instagram or Twitter or Facebook. But, you know, Dee, there's no replacing you. You know, you have truly been and are one of the best friends I've ever had. You're a sister. I hope that you're stuck with me for the rest of my life. And I love how you said yesterday on our call for the Beautiful Writers Group, you said, hey guys, there's no backstory here. Like, there's no drama. You know, it's all good.
Yeah, there's no cover-up. The friendship is lovely and strong. There is only ever support for each other's
and
creativity. I just, called Linda one day and just said, like, I can't do everything.
It's too much.
And, you know, this is part of my creative maturation. Like,
yeah.
I have a team now. I'm not obligated just to myself. I have like 9 women and a dude and some other women in another country that I have to support
so
with
stressful.
My creativity. And that only happens with focus, and focus isn't easy, but it always pays off. And I, you know, part of my prayer for this moving forward is that, you know, look, already Martha Beck coming on, Danny Shapiro, who's just one of the most beautiful writers, it's just going to add like richness and dimension, and even more people will get their creative, inspirational needs met. So yeah, all love, and you know where to find me.
Big, big love, everyone. Thanks so much, Dee, forever, forever. To hear Danielle and me chat with some of our previous guests,
like Elizabeth Gilbert, Seth Godin, Brené Brown, Stephen Pressfield, Mary Carr, Lisa Gibbons, Gretchen Rubin, Martha Beck, Danny Shapiro, Arianna Huffington, and more, head over to beautifulwriterspodcast.com, where you'll also see information about finding your writing tribe at the Beautiful Writers Group and or at a Carmel writing retreat. Thank you so much for listening, for taking this creative journey with us, and for staying tuned as the show evolves. I'm looking forward to it. Until next time, write on.